From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, did Governor Snyder really slash K-12 funding as his critics charge?
There was so many accusations being thrown around. He cut $1 billion. No, he didn't. And I just wanted to focus on just that one question.
Plus, the misadventures of Detroit's City Council President Pro Tem have some Detroiters saying, oh, no, not again.
People are talking about poor leaders instead of working and focusing on good leaders who are trying to change Detroit and the region.
And the ethical questions in managing health care costs.
When we look at the reasons why we have escalating health care costs, we find that there's going to be some pain, in effect, that's going to be required by denying patients some needed health care.
Those stories and more today. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for joining us. As Detroit continues the process of bankruptcy, there's been plenty of talk about turning over a new leaf in the city, a rejuvenation. But headlines recently turned to the misadventures of City Councilman George Cushingberry. On today's show, can Detroit change its image if there are still leaders courting controversy? And then we talk with an artist trying to change the way we think about abortion and issues of contraception and do it through art. But first, as Governor Snyder prepares to reveal his 2014-2015 budget tomorrow, there'll be many eyes fixed on just how much he proposes to put into K-12 education. In the Comeback Kid Snyder campaign ad, the one that was unveiled during the Super Bowl, amidst the talk of jobs was the claim education funding's up. Yet many of his critics claim Governor Snyder has cut $1 billion from K-12 education. So just what's the truth about education funding under the Snyder administration? Detroit Free Press Lansing reporter Paul Egan's been crunching the numbers. And Paul, you've done the analysis. Has Governor Snyder cut $1 billion from K-12 education?
The short answer is no, and it's a bit, you've kind of got to walk through it to understand why, because it certainly was reported at the time of Snyder's first budget that he'd recommended a $1 billion cut to education. And, you know, that was at least technically true, if a little bit unfair, because more than half of that amount, over $500 million, was lapsed federal funding that Snyder didn't directly control. But not only that, but as the budget process went on, as the year went on, even after they approved the budget, state finances improved. There was more money available. There was supplemental appropriation. And the other sort of tricky thing that happened was that it turned out that the estimates for the prior year they determined were incorrect, and that the last year of the Granholm administration, they had actually spent $180 million less on education than they expected. And so that made it easier for what Snyder spent to look less like a cut and more. It was easier for him to meet the previous year's spending.
Unless you're a CPA, I have to say it's very confusing.
It is confusing. And you know, the main reason I did this story, Cynthia, is there was so many accusations being thrown around. He cut $1 billion. No, he didn't. And I just wanted to focus on just that one question. How much state money was spent on K-12 funding year by year since Snyder took office? And, you know, I've gotten a lot of reaction to the story, both positive and negative. And most of the negative reaction has been, well, yes, but you're not considering the fact that, you know, if they hadn't made this change with the MBT, that there would have been more money in the school aid fund available. And actually, there was more money in the school aid fund available that they could have spent, but they transferred hundreds of million dollars to community colleges, which is true. And, you know, that's a fine debate to have, but as for the purposes of this story, it was a debate for another day. I just wanted to hit the pause button and say, let's get straight on the numbers. Let's see how much was spent year by year since Snyder came in. And that's what I hope the story accomplishes.
And as the headline in your piece said, Snyder boosted funding, but here's why it isn't helping students. So it almost sounds like there's ammunition for both sides.
Right. You know, I think the other thing the story does is help explain why, even if the state funding increased, it sure doesn't feel that way to most school superintendents. And that's for a number of reasons, too. But one of the main reasons is this money, which is the bulk of the increase, which was dedicated to this huge spike in their retirement costs, even the Snyder administration admits that although they gave all that extra money, it wasn't as much as those costs went up for the schools. And that's just been a big problem, the whole retirement system. And they decided back in 2010 to make this early retirement offer, which, you know, to entice more teachers to retire, they basically said, you know, we'll spike up your retirement benefits. And of course, a large number of teachers took that offer. And what it's done is pushed up how much money they're having to pay out, especially when you combine it with the fact that the stock market collapse in 2009 resulted in, you know, huge losses in their investment funds, and we're still paying for that. It's all supposed to level out by around 2017, but there was this huge spike in costs. And, you know, the fact is, if the government had put this money, instead of putting it into the retirement costs, if they put it into the foundation allowance, you know, the basic per pupil grant that students get, is that it would have been distributed equally to all the charter schools on a per pupil basis. Charter schools don't have those legacy costs, those retirement costs. And so school superintendents actually asked the Snyder administration to do it this way, where it's not in the per pupil grant. It's a separate amount that's based on their payroll so that they can better meet that retirement bill.
And what did it break down to when you say, you know, you wanted to hit the pause button and really take just a dollars and cents look? What did you find?
The last year under Governor Granholm, 2011 fiscal year, $10.7 billion. Mm-hmm. The first year under Snyder, after all was said and done, and keep in mind, schools still took a cut this year because of the cuts to the federal money. But if you look just at the state money, it actually went up about $100 million to $10.8 billion. Then the next year under Snyder, fiscal year 2013, went to $11 billion. And 2014, $11.4 billion. So a nicer jump there. And then and I know we're going to get to 2015, but we've also reported what the administration, you know, the budget that Snyder's going to present tomorrow, and that's supposed to bring it up another $322 million, which would be to $11.7 billion.
So that's a 2.8% increase. But then again, retirement costs are going to keep the big chunk of that from going into the classrooms, no?
That's correct. Yeah. Of the $322 million, $270 million of that, which is more than 80%, is again to cover that big retirement bill.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Detroit Free Press Lansing reporter Paul Egan, who's been looking at the numbers and trying to crunch all those numbers to get a sense as far as how much money has gone to K through 12 education under Governor Snyder. And so we're hearing that we can expect a $322 million boost in K through 12 school spending when we hear the budget tomorrow morning. What are we hearing from the Democrats as far as this advance word on school funding?
Well, I spoke to Mark Schauer yesterday, the Democratic candidate for governor, and he says that that's just a paltry amount in his mind, having $52 million increase after the retirement bill. He says that if he was a governor, he would make education his top priority, and he said that the surplus money, which is about $971 million over 3 years.
Right.
Of course, you can get into a big argument about how much of that. Some of it is one-time money, et cetera, that can't really be built into an ongoing budget. But Schauer said he would basically use whatever surplus funds were available to go to education.
Are there any other ways for districts to claw back a few more dollars for things other than retirement costs?
Yes, I mean, they, for one thing, they can cut their own costs, and they can, you know, some of this extra money that the Snyder administration has made available is for consolidation and or best practices. So in other words, they can get additional money and possibly also save money by combining on services with other neighboring school districts, that sort of thing. They can cut their own costs, but what I hear from superintendents you lose enrollment, whether it be from charter schools opening in your area, and the legislature has basically lifted that cap on charter schools now, so they're losing enrollment to that, or if you just lose enrollment through demographic changes, it's very hard from one year to the next if you've lost, you know, 250 pupils and all the funding that come with them, you know, to make an immediate adjustment that cuts your cost by a corresponding amount. That's very difficult for them to do. So, you know, they're also getting hit in another area, and although this is lessening now, but, you know, another area that we didn't look at because it's not direct state funding is with the whole decline in property values and appeals and everything that went on, they were losing local funding through declining assessments as well.
It's a spaghetti. It's a big clump of spaghetti, and trying to pick those pieces out individually and put it together to make numerical sense is a real challenge. And so I think I'm hearing the final take on this is yes, indeed, as Governor Snyder claimed, that K-12 spending increased since he's taken office. Although then we look at the numbers and realize the state's basic per pupil foundation allowance is down since he took office.
Yes, that's right, and it's really. Hopefully in the debate, which is a good debate that we should have, we can at least have some numbers we agree on as to where we are now, and then we can argue about where we should be or even where we should have been over the last few years.
Paul Egan, Detroit Free Press Lansing reporter, thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
Thanks, Cynthia.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What is your reaction when the conversation turns to America's soaring healthcare costs? When you hear the news that by 2020, just 6 years from now, our healthcare spending bill will hit $4.5 trillion. Well, maybe it's all too big, too macro for us to absorb on a personal level. So try this. Should your 92-year-old grandmother undergo coronary artery bypass graft surgery, costing upwards of $20,000? Or what about a girl who's 17 years old? Her leukemia treatments don't seem to be working, her liver's failing, other organs are failing, she is near death, and the family is demanding a liver transplant, which the surgeon proposed, but the HMO refuses to authorize. These are real-life dilemmas facing doctors, patients, facing us. We want everything modern medicine can offer. But as taxpayers, we want healthcare costs controlled. Is it possible to achieve both goals? Joining us now is Leonard Fleck, a professor of philosophy and a medical ethicist from Michigan State University. Welcome.
Thank you.
Can we achieve both of those goals?
We can, but it's not going to be easy or painless. That would be the short answer to the question. We want to control healthcare costs, but when we look at the reasons why we have escalating healthcare costs, we find that there's going to be some pain, in effect, that's going to be required by denying patients some needed healthcare. The main drivers of these escalating healthcare costs are all these emerging technologies, all the expensive cancer drugs, the heart procedures, and everything else that defines contemporary medicine. Plus, we have an aging population very rapidly because of the post-World War II baby boom generation. So that's another factor that's generating higher healthcare costs. And then thirdly, because of our prior successes in helping patients, for example, heart patients deal with heart disease, we end up with patients who are living longer, but living longer with more comorbidities of various kinds of chronic illnesses. So that's another factor that's driving up healthcare costs.
It really, as you drill down into this, there really are a lot of important philosophic questions that we need to face, aren't there?
Yes, there are. The philosophic questions are fundamentally moral questions. They are questions of healthcare justice. How do we go about fairly, justly determining which interventions ought to be available to everyone in our society, and which other interventions might fairly and justly be denied individuals because those interventions cost too much and do too little good or are too unlikely to do very much good.
And as technology keeps advancing in medicine, and at the same time we see our healthcare spending bill just hitting the stratosphere, we don't have the luxury of a lot of time to debate these questions, do we?
No, we don't. The issue of escalating healthcare costs actually sort of got on the radar way back in the 1970s, and we have not really done very much about it. In the 1970s, we were spending somewhere in the vicinity of 7% of our gross domestic product on health care. Last year, we were at about 17.6% of our gross domestic product. So the problem hasn't gone away, and in fact, as my initial comment suggested, it's really getting worse as we look out into the future.
So looking at that and looking into the future, and especially the immediate future as we baby boomers move up there, can we continue to cherish individual life and liberty in the pursuit of happiness and yet still promote health care justice and equality for all? Or are these mutually exclusive goals?
Well, there's no such thing as unlimited liberty with regard to pursuing our health care goals, because in some sense that's part of what's driving up the costs of health care today. When we're taxpayers or insurance premium payers, we want health care costs controlled because we are healthy. When we're sick and we have relatively good health insurance, then because we have relatively good health insurance or because we feel we've been paying into Medicare for years and years, we demand everything that medicine might offer, even if it can only do us a very small amount of good. One of the issues that's going to be of central concern over the next decade or so is going to be these extraordinarily expensive cancer drugs that typically have cost somewhere between $50,000 and $130,000 for a course of treatment. And for most patients who have advanced cancer, these drugs yield nothing more than relative gains in life expectancy of weeks to months. Well, that's a very high price to pay for what such a small gain.
I'm speaking with Leonard Fleck, who's a medical ethicist and a professor of philosophy from Michigan State University. That term, healthcare justice, what does that mean personally to you?
It means several different things, not just to me, but to what I'll call folks in our society at large. Sometimes it means everyone ought to be treated equally, that whoever has a particular medical problem ought to get the same treatment as anybody else with that medical problem, no matter what their level of income or social status. At other times, making just choices with regard to allocating healthcare resources has to do with trying to get the most good health good for the health dollars that we're spending. And at still other times, we say, well, individuals should have the right to spend their own money as they wish. And in different circumstances, each of those conceptions of justice is going to be appropriate. From my own point of view, part of what I argue is that the kinds of questions we have to address are questions that we collectively, all citizens in our society, ought to address through a process that I call rational democratic deliberation. We have to think about what sorts of health care we're in some sense unwilling to pay for in somebody else who is a stranger to us in a society of 320 million people. And if we're unwilling to pay for that health care for that stranger, well, if we're faced with the same problem and the same health care need, then we ought to be willing to deny that to ourselves. That is what's typically referred to as reciprocity, as a core element of our sense of health care justice.
And when you put it that way, and that idea of reciprocity, or if I say no to you, then I have to say no if I'm in your shoes, and we need respectful and rational democratic deliberation, as you put it. What hope do you have, Leonard, that as a nation we can actually pull off that kind of deliberation?
I'm something of an optimist, and so I believe it is possible to have those kind of conversations. I don't believe that on the basis of what you might call pure speculation. In the past, I have organized lots of these kinds of conversations within the community. But these are face-to-face conversations. They involve typically a group of 50 or so individuals from the community who are going to talk about these issues. And the virtue of face-to-face conversations is that individuals tend to be much more respectful to one another, as opposed to the kind of blogs and the talk radio shows where individuals are really talking as strangers and then their identities are essentially hidden. And so they tend to speak in ways that are clearly disrespectful and infuriating and so on.
You wrote a book in 2009 called Just Caring, Healthcare Rationing and Democratic Deliberation. And since your book came out, the Affordable Care Act became law. How do you feel that the ACA has impacted healthcare justice?
Well, it's impacted it, at least in this respect. It has improved access to needed health care, or will improve access to needed health care, for roughly 30 million of the 50 million currently uninsured in the United States. That represents, to my mind, a more just sort of health care system. The Affordable Care Act does a lot less than would be desirable in terms of controlling health care costs. In part, this has to do with the fact that some more conservative members of Congress have very much they've used various rhetorical strategies, the language of death panels and so on, to make much more difficult any effort to try to rein in health care costs.
How could philosophers like yourself guide the nation in the kind of debate that's needed to get our arms around this debate over health care costs?
Probably the most important sort of thing we can do is model the kind of conversation that ought to be had in our society, a more rational, reasoned kind of conversation, attentive to, respectful of whatever the medical scientific facts are, avoiding the kind of distortion, name-calling, and so on that gets in the way of having the kind of respectful conversations that are necessary.
And if we fail to answer these questions and have this democratic, rational democratic deliberation?
Well, the healthcare cost problem will get worse. If healthcare costs continue to escalate as they have, that will crowd out spending on other important kinds of social needs that ought to be met and ought to be funded publicly through government at one level or another. There is likely to be much more in the way of divisiveness in our society as there's more of a struggle to gain access to needed health care.
Leonard Fleck is a professor of philosophy and a medical ethicist from Michigan State University. His 2009 book is Just Caring, Healthcare Rationing, and Democratic Deliberation. Thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside.
You're very welcome.
Can art and history change the tone of the conversation in the pro-choice movement? Artist and activist Heather Ault believes it can. She's the founder of 4,000 Years for Choice. Heather has created an art series that presents abortion and contraception as a part of human history, a history of women seeking to control their reproduction. Her posters are currently on exhibit at the Lane Hall Gallery on the University of Michigan campus. Heather Ault, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Heather, what were you not seeing and hearing in the messages and images being used by the pro-choice movement that you want to address with your posters and your artwork?
Well, the series started as a real personal project. About 10 years ago, I was doing a lot of pro-choice activism in California, and I almost accidentally discovered the history of abortion and contraception through a historian's book. Her name is Linda Gordon. And it was so surprising to me that abortion and contraception were actually these ancient practices that people have been involved with throughout our, you know, entire history for thousands of years. And as an activist in the pro-choice movement, I had really only heard a narrative around, you know, stopping the war on women, fighting, struggling, and defending, and, you know, a real kind of battle cry to defend women's reproductive rights, rather than something that came out of our own human history and described that, you know, really this is something that people have been engaged in for, you know, it's as long as we can remember.
Thus, 4,000 Years for Choice, the group that you created. You say you want to replace the iconic wire coat hanger that's been used by the pro-choice movement for decades. So how do your posters and their messages do that?
We have had the wire coat hanger. And for many young people, this symbol doesn't really resonate. Anecdotally, I've talked to folks who've haven't had any idea what the coat hanger symbolizes. And in fact, it tells a story of not going back to the time of illegal abortion, you know, in back alleys and that kind of thing, when women were trying to, you know, take this into their own hands. So the work that I'm doing symbolizes a lot of other history that we really don't know about. Herbs, ancient condoms, diaphragms, IUDs, the many people who've been involved with talking about these issues, like Plato and Aristotle, and all sorts of folks that, you know, again, throughout history symbolize the issues around abortion and contraception, but, you know, don't ever come to mind because we're just not aware of this history. And so the series of words, each poster has a unique word on it, and they're intended to kind of draw people in and, you know, inspire them and shift the story just slightly so that, you know, folks have a feeling of kind of affirmation or goodness around these kinds of things that, again, are very stigmatized in our culture.
How important is message in this pro-choice movement, and where do you think that message should be? And why?
Well, it's incredibly important, you know, especially through, you know, social media and the way in which, you know, we are kind of invited to take action. Since abortion is such a personal issue for so many people, 1 in 3 women have an abortion in their lives, which also means that 1 in 3 men have a personal experience with abortion. Almost everyone knows someone who's had an abortion. And our mainstream political messaging often changes or affects how we personally carry this story and this experience through our lives. So I think that it's extremely important to kind of open up spaces for people to participate and provide stories that are just really inspiring and humanizing to this experience, rather than just political or, you know, around our activism. We also need to have these kind of personal stories as well. And I think history is such a wonderful way to kind of change this messaging, or kind of introduce a new component to it, at least.
Heather, when on the 4,000 Years for Choice website, there was a quote of yours that jumped out at me, and I'm going to read it to you. 4,000 Years for Choice is our story, a story of women's reproductive empowerment, wisdom, and self-care that dates back a millennium. I believe all people need to know this information, regardless of their position, whether they identify as pro-choice, pro-life, or somewhere in the middle. That was your quote on the website. And you know, as we're talking, there are people listening to this conversation who will see your artwork that focuses on a woman's reproductive freedom, and they're going to be saying, but what about that embryo or that fetus? What about defending that embryo or fetus? So what do you hope that the pro-life or somewhere in the middle people might take away from what you do?
That's such a great question. I think that I would just hope that folks see that abortion and contraception are part of a larger landscape for all women. We're not just fighting for the right to an abortion. We're also fighting for the right to the kind of support and services to raise our families, to have healthy pregnancies and give birth in ways that support our lives and our values. Women deeply care about childbirth and families and, you know, raising their children in healthy environments. And these issues are all connected. And I think that destigmatizing abortion is just one part of a larger set of goals that our movement is very much focused on right now. My hope is that this kind of work in the Lane Hall exhibit will bring people together and give them more opportunities to have these conversations.
Heather Ault is an artist and activist who is the founder of 4,000 Years for Choice, and her artwork will be on display at the Lane Hall Gallery on the University of Michigan campus through the end of this May. Heather, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you again.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When Detroit City Council President Pro Tem George Cushingberry was stopped by Detroit police, last month after leaving a Northwest Detroit strip club, police found an open glass of alcohol, an empty bottle of booze, a lit marijuana cigarette, and expired registration. Far from expressing any acts of contrition, Cushingberry claimed he had been stopped, quote, for driving black. It should be noted that the two Detroit officers who stopped him were African American and Arab American. Now, this has caused many in Detroit to do a collective facepalm, as in, oh no, not again. To talk about what this all means for the city in practical terms and in terms of the image of its leadership, we welcome back Detroit Free Press columnist Rochelle Riley. Hello.
Thank you.
And joining our conversation, always love having her, commentator, blogger, and author Karen Dumas. Welcome back, Karen.
Thank you, Cynthia. Appreciate it.
Rochelle, I'll start with you. From where you sit, what is more damaging to the city of Detroit, do you think? The traffic stop, and these allegations that he cheated legal clients, or the fact that he's agreed to have his law license suspended for 40 days, his dog ate my homework excuses, or the clear attempt to play the race card?
I don't think there's any delineation between any of them. All of it is embarrassing. All of it is unnecessary, and all of it takes us to a place where people are talking about poor leaders instead of working and focusing on good leaders who are trying to change Detroit and the region. It's not just the wrong time, because there's no right time to be, you know, embarrassing and to be a detriment to your city. But this is the worst time in the world for the same type of imbecilic type behavior that has happened in the past.
Karen, is it fair to say there are exceptionally high expectations of this retooled city council when you consider chosen by district for the first time in nearly a century, and then you couple that with the city's historic bankruptcy?
Well, I think the expectations are high because people are just controversy fatigued. I mean, I think that, you know, the city is at a point where we have to have high expectations and equally high delivery. You know, the city's not at a point where we're, you know, it's not no opportunity, it's not time for on-the-job training or to duplicate mistakes of the past. I mean, I think that, you know, constituents are justifiably just, you know, they're tired and they're ready for responsible leadership, and any indication that that's not there is not going to be tolerated.
Rochelle, when you hear this kind of thing and you think about the people in the city who so badly need strong leadership...
Well, you know, I'm frustrated in a way with voters, too. And I know people are beleaguered as they worry about bankruptcy. They worry about the economy. Right now we're worried about the weather, not being able to get, you know, kids to school and get to work. I just can't understand how there could be this many things going on in this man's career. It's almost like he's an habitual screw-up. And people not know enough about that to not elect him. I mean, this is somebody who was in the state legislature forever and then came home and ran for city council. I had somebody to call and say, so his job is literally to find a way to be paid by tax dollars as a career, and what do we have to show for it? So rather than talk about anything that he's accomplished, and maybe that's impossible, it's instead to look for excuses for bad behavior. And there have been a few activists who have... you know, try to claim that this is an attack on black leadership. This is not an attack on anyone. What it is a public examination of someone who is doing things in public that are embarrassing the city, embarrassing the region, and embarrassing the state. I haven't heard these, you know, and again, it's a minority, but I haven't heard these folks who are upset about, you know, people sort of piling on with George Cushenberry speak to the fact that if there were nothing to talk about, we wouldn't be talking about him. You know, if you're a good leader, nobody's asking why you're doing stupid things. If you're doing stupid things, you don't ignore that as some type of nod to any kind of leadership.
But then looking from the outside view, people outside of Detroit, maybe the folks who might be deciding whether to invest money, foundations or businesses, whether they want to perhaps relocate and bring jobs to Detroit, and you look at this track record of Detroit leaders. So you've got Kwame Kilpatrick and so many of his circle at City Hall and elsewhere. You've got Monica Conyers going to prison. You see Charles Pugh, former council president, with all of that, with the bankruptcy, to allegations of sexual involvement with a young man and then vanishing while he was council president. And then now we have Cushenberry. So does that not tarnish black leaders in Detroit?
And I think that that's what a lot of people, you know, can conveniently say. I mean, since Cushenberry wanted to start painting, you know, the race picture in this conversation, is that a lot of people figure or have attributed the city's demise financially, socially, even geographically in terms of, you know, the blight here in the city to failed black leadership. You know, I mean, and because there have been one, two, you know, whoever, I don't think that that's fair to say that every black leader, current or potential, you know, is not capable of delivering quality leadership. But I do think that that feeds into and further fuels the misperception that African Americans are unwilling or incapable of leading the city.
And let me speak to that, too, because it is so sad and so unfortunate and so unfair to the leaders who are doing a good job. This is the first election, this past election, that Detroit residents were able to elect council people by districts. you've got council members who are in their districts doing amazing things. James Tate has got an organization working in District 1 that's awesome. They're having community meetings. People are stepping up to not only make sure their leaders are accountable, but to become leaders. We're not having time to pay any attention to that because of the circus. So the people who really ought to be upset are the black leaders who are doing a great job and who, you know, seem to be painted with this broad brush because of people who aren't doing what they should be doing.
But hasn't City Council been awfully silent? And I'll start with Council President Brenda Jones, who basically said, well, why would you ask somebody to step down for a ticket?
the sigh you hear from both of us is, here we go again.
And look at the power, too. I mean, Rochelle, Cindy, I mean, what power do they have? I mean, and we've talked about and looked at how it appears that council has, you know, collectively been quietly cooperative, you know, during the bankruptcy process, the whole Kevin Orr thing, to maintain their positions. So, you know, that's kind of weighed into, you know, my perception as to why and how they are responding to this situation, and hopefully not indicating how they'll respond to future ones. Not controversy, mm-hmm. but just, you know,
challenges.
issues that come before them.
What do you think,
Rochelle?
I do
want these council members to be measured and thoughtful before they do things, because that has not been always true of some council members. But in instances like this, particularly instances where there are things that are known, we don't know everything, and there are things that were allowed to happen that shouldn't have happened. But if you know that there are things that are wrong, if a council member is apologizing for something, that means he's admitted that he's done something. I don't think that that all power is power by having, you know, all of the ability to govern, not having an emergency manager. I think some of it is power of perception. And I was very surprised. Well, actually, I wasn't surprised, but it would have been one of the things that would have been striking and different had this council censured George Cushenberry in some way or issued a statement letting them know that that is not indicative of the type of leadership that Detroit wants in its future, that they don't want to return to any of the past behavior that has made Detroit a national laughingstock, and that they're going to stay on top of just anything besides, well, we don't see anything really big, mm-hmm. or, you know, equating this to just the traffic ticket when it wasn't just about the traffic ticket. If you don't know everything about what happened, don't say anything until you do know. But once you do know, and once you do, I mean, now that his record over 30 years is becoming clearer and clearer, I don't know that you can sit silent, because there is power in silence, just like there's power in words.
You know, there were a lot of upset people in Detroit demanding an apology from Brooks Patterson, the Oakland County executive, for the things that he said about the city in that New Yorker magazine story. Do you think the same anger and energy is being aimed or should be aimed at George Cushenberry?
Well, you know, I thought it was interesting that there was a call for Kevin Orr to strip Cushenberry of his power from some of the same people who were, you know, calling for Kevin Orr to, you know, be stripped of his power as emergency manager. So, you know, this whole cycle, you know, has just been kind of mind-boggling. But I don't think that people in the city are, you know, embracing or supportive of the behavior of Cushenberry. I just think a lot of people don't know what to do anymore. You know, where do you go? What do you do? How do you establish a level of accountability and then hold your elected officials to that? I think people are confused about that process. But it goes back to, like Rochelle said, you know, this may not or should not be a surprise to many. I mean, he's not new to the political scene.
And the other thing is, this is kind of apples and oranges, only in that the New Yorker, you know, you can hold. You can look at it online. You can see the words. What Brooks did is what Brooks did.
Yeah.
There's an investigation that's still continuing in this case. And I think what people are doing are watching to see just how much, just how deep, just how far before they make some comment. And like Karen said, that's just the ones that are paying attention. For a lot of people, this is just business as usual. They get sick of all of it. A lot of them don't vote because, and I finally am beginning to actually understand why some people don't vote. As much as it pains me and as much as I get really upset about it, if your choices are the choices that they have and they really just don't want to do it, what do you do? I mean, lesser of two evils may be evil, still evil. I just think there's a level of frustration and a level of concern that makes people focus more on what they're doing for their families and themselves and their work than continuing to wade into the morass of trying to understand what's happening with government. And that can be the biggest loss of all.
And in your column right after this all happened, Rochelle, I thought was so from the heart, where you said, how long before the Detroit standard of leadership will not be someone who will drive around with a liquor bottle in the backseat from a party the week before, looking for exemplary leadership? And as you say, some of those folks are in there, but... when you, I can see what you're saying. The frustration is really hard to even put into words.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, Detroit has hundreds of people who not only are exemplary leaders, but are stellar people. But they are not serving in those positions. And I've talked to some of them who said they don't want to be a part of the circus. They're not going to participate in what they've seen. So sometimes what you get is the people who are willing to step up, who either are great leaders who get lumped in with people who aren't, or who are novices who are trying to learn on the job when there's a lot going on. I mean, you're talking about somebody with 30 years of political experience and experience, you know, cutting deals and doing backroom stuff, who may not be the best for the city, but who understands politics. So you get somebody like that at a table with someone who may have been running for office, not for their first job, but maybe their second job. And you've got to tangle with all of that. It's a wild dance. It's a lot of work. I get people calling me every week, you know, about better leadership, who could run. And you can't make people do this job. This is a hard, almost impossible job that's made even more impossible now by waiting for the governing authority that, you know, voters gave you but you don't have right now, trying to figure out what to do. I just think there's a lack of pride in what the job means. I can remember growing up, and the people who were in positions of authority, it wasn't about power, it was about authority and leadership. You didn't walk around without a tie. You didn't use poor language. You didn't let anybody see you in a compromising position. It meant something. It's so different now till it's just sad.
And is there an answer? Do you see a way out? Is there a takeaway from all of this, Karen, for Detroit's elected leaders? We'll start with that.
Well, you know, again, people have, and I agree with Rochelle, you know, on the surface, you know, we have the appearance of a more lax approach to the position. But public service is and should be about that, public service, not self-service. And I think that has shifted over the years drastically. You know, as you pointed out earlier, you know, we see career politicians, they go from payroll to payroll. We could sit here and have an hour discussion. Mm-hmm. About elected officials that just move from position to position and whose track record, in my opinion, may not necessarily justify such. But I think it goes back to voting and being engaged, being aware of the process, you know, and showing a lack of intolerance by not consistently reelecting people who have proven themselves unworthy in the past.
And when you're trying to get the message out to the rest of Michigan that Detroit does matter and that we're all in this together, it sure doesn't help.
Well, there are two things they can do. One is to move to a weak mayor form of government and have a city manager actually manage the city. And the other is to make the positions of city council unpaid so that the only people who will run for those jobs are people who are interested in public service and not a public check.
Yep.
Always great talking to both of you, commentator, blogger, and author Karen Dumas. Thank you so much. And Detroit Free Press columnist Rochelle Riley. And we look forward to talking with you again. Thank you.
Thank you.
Today we look at The Snowboard, another Michigan-made story.
The state of Michigan.
Ensuring quality products today.
The Sochi Winter Olympic Games are just days away. One of the most popular competitions is undoubtedly snowboarding. But there might have been no Shaun White, no Flying Tomato grabbing Olympic gold for the U.S. without a man from Muskegon looking to give his little girls a reason to play outside in the snow. Joining me is Sherman Poppin, the man who invented the original snowboard some 48 years ago. Sherman Poppin, good to have you on the program.
Well, very happy to be here.
So, Sherman, what were you trying to do that Christmas day in 1965 in your garage?
We lived on the shore of Lake Michigan in Muskegon, and they had about, well over a foot of snow on Christmas Eve. So we got up Christmas Day, and after the toys were used, my wife decided that we ought to get outside and play because it was a little hectic. I took these two small skis and put them side by side and put a brace across them to hold them together and something to put your foot against. And we literally started sliding down a hill, standing up.
Tell us how your wife came up with the name for this new toy.
The kids were having so much fun, and I suddenly realized we were really surfing the snow. She put the contraction of the word snow and surf together and came up with the word snurfer.
And, Sherm, how long did it take for the name to morph into snowboard?
Well, now this is 14 years after I did it, and you have to realize patents are only good for 17 years. What happened was Jake Bergen Carpenter, the carpenter of the Burton boards, he came to one of the contests in Western Michigan in 79. He saw what was going on, and he got pretty excited with his own stuff, and he went back to Vermont and started making snurf boards. And so I wrote him, say, the word snurf and any derivative thereof belongs to Sherman Poppin. And if you want to keep making these things, you're going to have to pay him a royalty. That was probably one of the dumbest things I ever did, because he stopped making snurf boards and started making snowboards.
You know, I got to wonder, Sherm, when you watch snowboarders like Shaun White just blow the crowd away, that was one of the big memories of the last Olympics. Can you believe it, from Muskegon to Sochi?
No, I really can't. And I can remember the very first time it was in the Olympics, I really just couldn't get away from the set watching them. I just couldn't believe that it all started in my little workshop.
Sherm Poppin, it has been a pleasure to meet you, and thank you so much for sharing the story of something that's a part of so many people's winter fun.
Okay, well, it's fun to be part of it. Thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Haddle, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, and Claire Tennisketter. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.